Yeah. I'll show the movie once more for those of you who came late. So the first thing that happens is the high-gain antenna comes out, and these two, they're bigger than a garage door, platforms on which the sun shield rolls out. First, this arm comes out with a telescopic tube, and then the arm on the other side comes out, and then the five layers will separate with pulleys along these bars. This gets all tested on the ground in one gravity, of course, and using engineering modeling, make sure that it works just fine in zero gravity as well. And then last, once the sun shield is in place, the secondary mirror comes down on a redundant mechanism there. There's motors back here that bring that arm down. So, and then the side panels fold forwards like the basically the sides of a milk carton where three mirrors are mounted of the 18 on each side. And then you've got a telescope that should cool itself to 40 kelvins. The sun is, of course, always down on this side, and the telescope will always look in the dark. We'll get to this. Let me put this away here.
What is the plan B, C, D, E, and Z in case some of those multiple steps fail?
You resign.
Well, that
I mean
the answer is you try many times. They can apparently, I don't know where the movie went, you can deploy the sun shield about 11 times before they start worrying about cracking it or falling it. It's made out of Kapton, which is a very highly, well, as you get to the real slides, it's in there somewhere too. It's a very highly reflective kitchen surround wrap that you use to wrap your food, except it's much more expensive and very reflective.
Sorry, how long is the arm? I mean,
Well, from here to here is 6.5 meters. So this is not a whole lot shorter. The entire sun shield is bigger than this room, about twice the size. It's about the size of a tennis court. So it's big. What you maybe didn't appreciate compared to this telescope been up in orbit 26 years, and it sees 15 sunrises and 15 sunsets a day, right? It's pretty painful on the astronauts too if you go out there low Earth orbit. This telescope sees one sunrise and one sunset in 14 years. The sunrise happens when the launch fairing comes off 10 minutes after launch. And the sunset happens when the sun shield deploys. And then, you know, if all goes well with the gyros and the reaction wheels, it should never see the sun again. So it's a big difference. Okay, so that's the topic for today. By the way, on tomorrow, do you want me to do the crayon talk, or you want me to talk? Yeah, definitely crayon. Okay, so then I'll need to decide on the topic, either reionization or just lessons learned from JWST. That's probably more interesting. I won't get to
Leave
that.
it up to you.
Yeah? Okay.
Choose.
I have a talk ready on both, but one requires a lot of images, which I didn't print. The other one is
That's
just.
the only rule. It has to be black.
Yeah, well, that will use the other talk, but for which I only have text. Yeah? Basically, there will be a discussion about lessons learned from this $8 billion project. So, alas, a large cast of folks involved in this with me when we get our guaranteed observing time in hopefully 3 years, including a number of students at ASU who are now elsewhere also. So, what we'll do is give you a hardware update of the telescope as of this month, and then dwell on how JW will measure galaxy assembly and supermassive black hole growth. I'll give a couple of examples. And then how we'll measure the epoch of first light and reionization. And I'll handshake with the Planck 2016 results, which are also important for this. In fact, I had an earlier version. I took this out last night, handshaking with the LIGO results on the early supermassive black holes. I'm sure you guys have discussed this, and the talk got too long, so I took it out, but we can discuss it later. No. Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Should be coming to
Good, good. I heard they actually had half a dozen events, the best one of which they published.
Today they're announcing the second.
Oh, then, good, good, yeah. All right, well, anyway, so this is my summary chart of the project. So what scientist wants is in the upper left corner, and what the project manager sees is what, you know, the overloaded program that's undoable. And God forbid that you end up with something like this or semi-functional like that. So there's always a balance between what you can do money-wise and technology-wise and schedule-wise, and making sure you can still do the science. So we want something close to this, but sometimes we have to sacrifice a few things, as you will see, which is why Planck results have been so important. Because 10 years ago, 11 years ago now, they wanted to descope the telescope. They want to take the two side panels off, which would have resulted in an oval point spread function. That would have been terrible. But what's even worse, they wanted to completely forgo the 1 micron performance. And the WMAP year 3 results had come out. And I said, not over my dead body, because tau keeps coming down. And you know, you can't see first light if you sacrifice the 1 micron performance. So there's a small range of overlap in wavelengths between the Hubble Space Telescope and the James Webb Space Telescope. Of course, this is a UV optical near-infrared telescope. This is a near-to-mid-infrared telescope. And James Webb, since it's 2.5 times larger, 2.4 meter compared to 6.5 meter corner-to-corner, the same wavelength, you get 2.5 times better resolution, or at 2.5 times longer wavelengths, you will have the same resolution as Hubble has in the optical. So just for the record, the HST works from slightly below Lyman alpha to almost 2 microns. JWST works from the visual red, basically R-band, all the way to 29 microns. And Spitzer is currently still working 3.5 to 4.5 microns, but once upon a time it worked in the far IR as well. What's plotted vertically is the effective collecting area, obviously much larger for James Webb compared to both Hubble and Spitzer. So in the areas of overlap, JWST will far outdo any of the other telescopes, 25 square meter collecting area. I should have brought my remote control. So, James Webb was the second NASA administrator, not the author of this book. That was a once upon a time good writer. Then he became a senator in Virginia, Jim Webb, until he retired. But so James Webb, the other Webb, the second NASA administrator, brought us to the moon under JFK, and the telescope is named after him. You can see here, this is not a real telescope, of course. It's in the Washington Mall in front of the Capitol building. It got bird poop on it and so on, but it's life size. You can see the size of human beings over here. You can also see that it's pretty high profile in terms of its visibility in front of Congress. Almost nothing standing in the way between James Webb and Capitol building, except for some military spending here. Oh, I should have noticed that. That must be a theorist's pointer. All right, very good. So I say that a little tongue-in-cheek because we actually benefit from what other branches of government are doing, and occasionally we feed lessons back, which turned out was critical for survival when we ran over budget 6 years ago. Happened several times. I'll talk about that tomorrow. So as I said, 25 square meter collecting area, the five layers of Kapton when the sun is always here, and of course the Earth and the Moon as well, because we go in the L2 Lagrange point, we go around the sun every year together with the Earth. You will see the landscape in just a minute. So around 300 kelvins on this side, every layer reduces the ambient temperature by about square root of 3, so you get down to about 40 kelvins here. And so the telescope is really an infrared telescope working between, as I said, the red and 28 or 29 microns. And so as long as the temperature's around 40 kelvins, you should be able to do imaging, not routinely. It takes about a day of integration time to about 31.5 magnitude, which is about one nanojansky for the radio or ALMA astronomers in the audience. Spectroscopy, of course, a few magnitudes brighter. And so that takes about a day of integration time. And for the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, it took about 841 orbits or 600 hours to get that faint. So it's about 20 or 30 times faster than Hubble at the same wavelength. It will go up in Ariane 5, so inside the launch vehicle on top, it will be folded up as you saw at the beginning of the movie. And then after, as I said, 10 minutes later, the launch fairing will open up, the telescope will separate. It's 6,500 kilograms, we're a couple of hundred kilograms underweight right now. That's also new. A couple of years ago, we were overweight. We had to undergo a Jenny Craig weight loss program, which was a good thing because we can now use the spare weight we have to fill up the propellant tank completely. The manager wouldn't let us in the past, but now we can fly with the full tank of gas, which means we can maximally live 14 years instead of 5 or 10 years. Whether the hardware will last that long, we'll need to see. But anyway, that's good news, I think. So the Earth is right here in the Earth-Sun Lagrange system, the three-body problem. This is the orbit of the Moon, this white circle. And so L2 is roughly here. It's about 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. The Sun would be over there, 100 times further away than the Moon or so. And you don't sit still there. It's not a stable Lagrange point, as you know. It's not L4 or L5, so you have to do also a vertical amplitude around, as well as a horizontal amplitude around the L2 point, so that you don't drift off. If you don't use a little propellant every few weeks to steer yourself, you will start orbiting the Sun like Spitzer does, and we don't want to do that, because we want to always have the Earth and the Moon and the Sun behind the sun shield. The Earth and the Sun.
What's the probability that it will crash into WMAP?
I calculate that once. A very good question. So we have, it's about a million by a million by a million kilometers, right? So it's 10 to the 18 cubic kilometers, which is a hell of a lot more volume than there is in low Earth orbit, the shell around Earth where all the spacecraft are. And we have WMAP there, Planck, Herschel, and you tell me what else is there. Three spacecraft in 10 to the 18 cubic kilometers. So I think the chances are essentially zilch. We're more worried about micrometeorites. That's a whole other story. I took my charts on that topic out, but ask me at the end. We will run into some micrometeorites. The sun shield is built for that. So after 10 years, the sun shield will look like a Texas road sign and will have holes in it. But most micrometeorites, you know, they'll come from comet trails which go around the sun in, you know, a trail that is fairly well aligned with the Earth's orbit that crosses under some angle. So most comet trails will actually not hit the sun shield perpendicularly, but under a shallow angle, which means the hole in layer one will never be seen by layer five or the telescope. I have a picture of that I took out, but I will show you the Whitefield Camera 3 in just a minute. It had been in space for a couple of years before it was launched. It's a recycled Whitefield Camera 1. And that had a number of micrometeorite pockmarks on the surface. The titanium shield was about as large as this table. So you can calculate the density. It's a well-known problem. I don't talk about this much. You have seen the movie already, so I'll spare you this. Only to say that all this deployment with redundant mechanisms, you know, if this motor fails, there's another motor here and there's another one on the other side. Everything gets tested in one gravity. And then in some cases you will see that we offload the test for zero gravity because the motors don't have to work in one gravity. They need to work in zero gravity, which means they need to actually do less work. When you launch. Everything is being built as of today. We're more than 99% complete. You will see the 18 flight mirrors in just a minute. They're meet the 40 Kelvin specs. So the way it works, beryllium, I have another movie on this which I haven't shown. It's a very highly poisonous material. It's like, it's in the upper left corner of the periodic system above aluminum. It behaves like aluminum, except it has a much lower coefficient of thermal expansion, so you can really build it at room temperature and it'll have the same shape at 40 Kelvin, which of course is what you want. Except that it is also highly carcinogenic. It gives you lung cancer if you breathe the beryllium powder. So it is a special art to make this stuff. There's a whole industry that makes these mirrors about the size of that table, almost the same size, about 1.35 meters across. And behind the mirror, of course, the hexagon structure to give it its stiffness, and there are these mechanisms, we call them hexapods or actuators, that give the mirror 7 degrees of freedom. So there is a push and a pull, a translate in two direction, a rotate, a tip and a tilt, and a radius of curvature. And if any one of these fails, there's a backup one that can immediately take over its function. If all six of them would fail, or at least 4 out of 6, the mirror will only have partial ability to move, and it can still move the other 17 mirrors completely, so you can still have a working telescope. If 2 mirrors should fail, then you hope that you can at least point 1 mirror off to the side and point it at Venus or something, and work with the 17-mirror telescope. So this system is quite forgiving against failures, and you'll see it will be tested many times. Prototypes have been tested, because it's no different than the Keck telescope or the HET telescope in Texas, except those have 36 mirrors, and here you got 18. There's one important difference, though. With Keck telescope, I think, because of wind shake and atmospheric turbulence, you do the wavefront sensing 20 times a second or 50 times a second. We do it every 2 weeks. So we're a very passive telescope, yeah? Because once you have temperature, you shouldn't really have to do much. So primary mirrors, all gold-coated, secondary mirrors, tertiary mirrors. You'll see the final products in a minute. The support structure that holds the mirrors themselves, the various electronic components, the spacecraft bus, the sun shield. You'll see it all in detail in a minute. But as of this month, more than 99% of launch mass is designed and built. It's actually more than 70% that has been weighed. I think at this point it's probably 90-some percent weighed, because last week an important event happened. The instrument module was mated with the telescope. So each one of these beryllium mirrors gets carefully tested in a chamber. You know, we take the technician out, close the tank, pump it vacuum. In this case, it was an X-ray facility in Huntsville, Alabama, where the beryllium mirrors were tested for cracks. And indeed, they were fine, but you want to make sure that you don't have any cracks in the beryllium. And here's the backplane for the first 6, so the entire telescope looks 3 times bigger than that, with the hexapods and all the cabling in place that is needed to move the parts. So the final product looks like this, all 18 mirrors in terms of the surface accuracy in nanometers. The requirement is 25 nanometers, and you see most of these mirrors meet or exceed that, except for these two. There's one here that's almost twice as bad, and this one here also around 40 nanometers RMS. So let me back up a step. You know that the Hubble Space Telescope was the most precise UV optical mirror ever made, precisely to the wrong figure by mistake, right? I mean, the young folks in the audience won't remember this, but the Hubble mirror was just polished the wrong prescription. And of course, only because the astronauts serviced the telescope, we could get away with it. These 18 mirrors are the most precise infrared mirrors ever polished at room temperature. Listen carefully to the precisely the wrong shape. So when you bring them down to 40 Kelvin, they have exactly the right shape. And the difference between room temperature and 40 Kelvins is very low. Now, they work perfectly for 16 out of 18 for these two. These were the first two they did. They had slightly the wrong polishing prescription in there. And I was initially upset about that, but it was going to cost several $100 million to redo it, so they're not going to do it. And this one is behind one of the support bars for the secondary, and so is this one, the 30-degree rotated support bar. So even for, as we'll see in spectroscopy or imaging of high-redshift quasars, you will never notice that these two are a little off. So the project decided not to redo them, take them as it is. The overall RMS is better than 25, and that's all we need. So we're diffraction limited, not only in K-band to 2 microns, but we're the minimum lambda over D is actually at much shorter wavelength. The best resolution we'll get is in J-band at 1.2 microns. So the telescope is nearly perfect as long as everything works. That's the family portrait of all 18 in there. Looks like a retirement home dinner ball. It's basically the shipping container. They're quite large. That's where they were shipped in. By the way, they're gold coated, not because the project has so much money, but because obviously in the infrared you want to have gold. Gold looks yellow and it has very high reflectivity at 98% at 1 and 2 microns. And so even though you have, in some cases with spectrographs, 14 reflective optics between the light source and yourself, the detector, you still only lose a few tens of percent of the light because of the high reflectivity. If it used silver or aluminum, this would have been much less good. Of course, Hubble, everything is aluminized, but in this case, it's goldized. So just a summary of how the technical construction was all done. The mirror elements were put on the support structure, the spectrographs and imagers in this box called ISIM, the instrument module, have been mounted on the back as of this last week. As you saw, the secondary mirror is on this tripod, which has been tested for folding, and now the entire telescope is going to be mounted with this support pole to the spacecraft, which is underneath the folded up sun shield. So we're more than halfway done through this final assembly. Let me show you some pictures on that. So this is an engineering model seen from the top, where the secondary mirror is not here yet, but where the mechanism was tested. There's a movie of this, which I didn't include, but you can see all these guys in bunny suits in the clean room walk around, and it sounds like they're cheating because they're testing these motors, and it sounds like they're pushing and pulling. They're not actually doing that. The motors work just fine, but they're offloading the gravity, right? Because these bars are quite heavy, and the motor was not designed to produce that much force, because this installation, once this mirror comes down over the side and in front of the primary mirror, is actually quite a mechanical shock that could cause the detectors. And when these two side panels fold forward, that's another mechanical shock that happens here. So you don't want to make the motors too strong. So everything gets tested at just the right force level in one gravity. And here you can see that NASA has its ducks in a row in the sun shield. So this is the engineering model for the sun shield with one guy in the middle there too. I've been in this clean room, sat in a bunny suit and looked over there. It's pretty impressive. It's very shiny, which is actually a problem if you think about it, because we live in this nasty place called the solar system, which has a sun and Jupiter, which are bright enough, and then we live in a galaxy, which is a really bright infrared source. And so here you got the world's shiniest sun shield with a galaxy right above you that's more or less everywhere in the sky that will shine on the sun shield and produce stray light off the secondary onto the mirror. So this telescope is not like Hubble or Spitzer, which have a closed tube. It's very open, and therefore we will get some stray light, which is actually a concern for high redshift galaxies and clusters, because clusters have intercluster light, which is real, and stray light is not real, so we need to learn to separate the two. Anyway, here's the first two engineering mirrors mounted on the engineering model, which is how the technicians learned how to do this, and then in the subsequent process, they took actually the flight support structure and mounted all the mirrors. It's very precise work, all done in a clean room. This is as of a good number of months ago. They started building up the mirror with the final segments. This was from a telecon in February. They were almost done with it. And here's the picture as finished with the mirror covers on. That was at my special request, because they were initially in the project, before they run over budget, they were going to do everything upside down so the mirror would hang off the ceiling so it wouldn't collect dust for a few years. We heard about dust this morning. We don't want dust on this infrared telescope mirror. And so we have mirror covers to make sure that no undue amount of dust collects on the mirror. It wasn't terribly popular, but we'll show you in a minute how that's done. We have these two professional divers on diving boards here that hang above the mirror and take tea dust covers off without scratching it, please, because that's the real beryllium gold-coated mirrors underneath. Right, so this happened in the last few months, and as of about a month ago, it looks like this. That's the real telescope. with the secondary mirror stowed here, as it's supposed to be stowed, and it's looking at the ceiling in the big clean room of Building 29 in Goddard Space Flight Center. This enormous merry-go-round is how you can, you know, move it up and down and turn it upside down if you like. Is necessary. So notice there is the NASA Goddard logo in the back on the wall there, which is important because here's another family shot of the mirror. And now the mirror has been on this merry-go-round, turned around, it's facing the visitors gallery. We had a picture of John Mather there, I forgot to put that in, but this is on the surface of the mirror, it's the NASA logo against the back wall, highly magnified. So yes, the mirror does have the right prescription. It does not have spherical aberration, but it did show off the NASA meatball. And so that's what it looks like. It looks almost like, but that's the real thing, right? The real gold-coated mirror. It looks very clean and very yellow, as it should be. So there it is. Now, unfortunately, the mirror covers are taken off, so it's collecting some dust, not a lot. I heard in Monday's telecom, but enough that they occasionally go back with a diving board and a guy with a very light brush or a vacuum cleaner takes off the last dust speck. Now, the instrument module, the Canadian Fine Guiding Sensor holds the telescope still while it's locked onto two guide stars and two different fields of view. Worth between 1 and 5 microns. The same for the U of A Lockheed near infrared camera, except that that's the real imager that also accesses the wavefront sensor. You'll see more in a minute. That's the real hardware. Europeans also made the near infrared spectrometer, as well as the mid infrared instrument between JPL and European consortium. This is it in schematics. Just to list the wavelength range, the MIRI has really runs to 29 microns, but it picks up at 5 to 29 microns. The near-infrared camera and spectrograph each work roughly between 0.6 and 5 microns. 0.6 microns, the performance is really not very good. Hubble will still be better in V-band. However, in R-band, 775 and 814, we have similar filters than that. We have an 090 filter. James Webb will outdo Hubble by a good bit, and then in J-band and beyond, you know, pretty much quickly beyond 1 microns, we will outdo Hubble by a very large amount, and of course the same for Spitzer. So there's a small area of overlap, and then the blue side of that, Hubble still outperforms James Webb, but again, our diffraction limit is 2 microns, so it's a miracle that we do as well as we do at 1 micron. It was made in 27 states, which was important when the project ran into some political trouble a few years ago. It will go up with the Ariane 5, as I said, so there's 10 European, more than 10 countries involved that build both the mid-infrared instrument as well as the near-infrared spectrograph, plus Canada, of course, which provided the FGS, which also has an nearest GRISM spectrograph, as we'll see in a minute. So it's a really good combination of imaging and spectroscopy. Let's say you take an image of an arbitrary deep field, or in this case with the cluster, you could, with the micro shutters in NERSPEC, you could open up these little doors or louvers. They're about 0.2 by 0.4 millimeters, so this would be about the size of a millimeter. No, this would be the size of a millimeter. And they open up magnetically, mechanically, and you can also close them at will. And that means that at every location where you expect a galaxy or star of interest, you could produce a spectrum from, let's say, a deep field. You want to make sure that these spectra don't unduly overlap. You could even open it up any way you like. Here's the JWST logo. It's not very useful for spectroscopy, but you could do that. There's a couple of shutters, in fact, quite a few that are failed closed, and there are a few, quite a few less that are failed open. The failed open have been painted over with some epoxy or something to make sure they don't cause too much stray light. The failed closed, that are just the way it is, it's 64,000 of these in each of 4 quadrants. So there's a lot of little micro shutters, most of which always remain closed unless you open them up. But some of them are permanently closed, and you just have to schedule around that. That means in some cases you have to take exposures twice. So the entire instrument package has been... It looks like a chip, basically. It's the size of a big piece of silicon. There's 4 of them So, you know, 0.2 millimeters times the square root of 64,000.
64,000.
Yeah, 64,000 in total. So however many that is, probably 250 or so on each side. I think it's a 256 array. So this was first done in 2014 to test all the instruments to make sure they basically talk to IRF and our instrument control packages. And then from this last October till February, you know, big tank, put the instrument in, cable it up, make sure it talks to the computer, remove the technicians, close the lid, pump it vacuum, bring it down to 40 kelvins. And that worked just fine. Couple of times around. There were glitches, of course. There were hardware failures this way. Yeah, you don't want to know this, but Maryland has doesn't have much of a winter, but they had a pretty bad snowstorm in January. So building 29 had about 5 feet of snow or so on the roof, which was the equivalent of, I think it was like 10 Olympic-sized pools or so worth of water on top of the telescope. And we tried to keep everything, you know, dry. But of course, the clean room was itself not affected. So here's the instrument package mounted behind the telescope. This is not the mirrors themselves. This is a radiator. The telescope is now upside down. You can see the mirrors back here. So it's basically cupped down for a moment, where the instrument package gets lowered in its final position right behind the radiators here and cabled up to be connected to, this happened I think 2 weeks ago. And here's the telescope before it receives the instrument package. The instrument package goes right behind here. At that point it was still looking at the visitors gallery, which is over here if you've been there. Anybody can go while you need to get access to Goddard. But so now we're in the last stage, in the next 2 years, where it will go into the world's largest thermal vacuum chamber to be tested for the correct optics. There's a test set of equipment in the top of the chamber here, and the telescope will sit in its entirety at the bottom there. I have, never mind all the details here, but it's used for wavefront sensing and make sure that the mirrors themselves indeed focus properly and that all the mechanisms work and so on. This chamber was, it's more than half a century old. It was built in the 1960s for the moon landing. So the entire, not Saturn V, but the Apollo capsule, the moon lander and the astronaut capsule was in there in the 60s to be tested for space. So they close again the enormous door. This, I think, is a 14-meter door or so after the telescope wheels in. This is the engineering model with only two mirrors mounted, just to make sure that the entire room functions and does the test as advertised, and that, you know, technicians don't drop anything from the ceiling, which you don't want to do in these mirrors. For the record, somebody dropped a wrench once out of the 200-inch prime focus cage on Mount Palomar on the mirror. Now, that was a big borosilicate mirror, so not much happened to it. It got a little dent in it, but you don't want to drop anything on our precious beryllium mirror. So that test chamber will first get tested on the test model, make sure the test itself works. And then in December, when everything is gone through its final checks at Goddard Space Flight Center, it will be shipped to Houston and will be tested in that chamber. So now we're going to get to the second part, a quick wheel through the galaxy assembly and supermassive black hole growth. So this is actually an image I'm very proud of, the Hubble Wide Field Camera 3 in 10 filters, also using some ACS filters, pretty much between 0.2 and 2 microns in wavelength, reaching, you know, 27 magnitude, which is for Wide Field Camera 3 not that deep. This is just an hour or two per filter. You can go several days per filter and go much fainter in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. But James Webb will routinely do 4 magnitudes fainter, for the record. That's, you know, about a firefly at the distance of the moon, with the moon not there, of course. And it will typically do this at wavelengths between 1 and 29 microns, which, of course, as we learned this morning, having the infrared is very good to trace both young and old stars and the effects of dust. You can see most elliptical galaxies aren't actually dead. They got UV light in the center. They're not completely red and dead. But there is, you can sort of see it here against the glare from the door, some grouping here in the background, which is about a redshift 0.7, and then there's a lot of faint red galaxies that I'll show you better in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field in a minute, which are the high redshift objects. Here's the Hubble Wide Field Camera 3 as it came back in, it was the original Wide Field Camera 1, been in space for 3 years with the original launch of Hubble. So together with its housing and the titanium outer shield, came back in December of 93 after the first servicing mission. And that was then turned into Wide Field Camera 3. So the mechanism, the latches and all that, we knew it would fit because it'd been in a telescope since launch for 3 years. And so it was completely refurbished into the camera you're well familiar with. I bring this up because this titanium sunshield, about the size of this table but curved, had about 200 pock marks on it. They were mostly microscopic, but they were typically from, you know, things maybe 10 or 20 microns across, or micrometeorites hitting at 35 kilometers a second just outside the Earth's orbit. So, you know, they didn't actually cause any physical damage, but you could see them. And you'll get the same density over 5 or 10 years, you know, in fact a few higher perhaps, in L2. So you will turn the sunshield into something that will have a lot of holes in it. And there will be hits to the mirrors as well. But since the power law distribution of these micrometeorites is very steep, it goes R to the minus 3.5, you know, the chance you'll get hit by something that's a fraction of a millimeter or, God forbid, bigger is pretty small in a lifetime telescope. Let me just, you know, skip through this real quick, just other than to say that the panchromatic properties of Wide Field Camera 3 are really good for looking at high redshift galaxies, as you all know. And so Wide Field Camera 3 was really a panchromatic camera compared to the ACS, which was a little more sensitive, but only over a much narrower range in wavelength. And we've really put that to good use to look both at the assembly of galaxies as well as AGN growth. I'll start with my famous radio galaxy here, my favorite radio galaxy, Centaurus A, just to illustrate the point that galaxies do have dust, in case you forgot how much dust Centaurus A has. I think the central accretion disk, which you can see just fine in X-rays coming out, radio waves, both sides, is somewhere in the middle here behind 27 magnitude of visual extinction. So I want you to keep this in mind when you think about these high redshift quasars, because I'm going to argue that they're no different than this, except that the quasar, of course, shines straight in your face. By the way, we had some very nice evidence for jet-induced star formation. The radio jet comes out in this direction, and quite far away, about 5 kiloparsec, is actually a bout of very young stars, about a million years old. And the merger, of course, that caused this galaxy is many billion years old, or at least a billion years, I'd say. The radio jet was activated more recently and caused some interesting jet-induced star formation. Now let's imagine a much much bigger, more active central engine at a redshift 6. So here's a quasar redshift 6. In fact, it's the famous quasar redshift 6.42, 18.5 magnitude in J-band and H-band, 1.6 microns. That's the actual image itself. This is the best contemporaneous image we could get over nearby star, same two-mass color, same part of the sky. We actually did very tricky scheduling to make sure that the thermal environment of the quasar observation and the star observation were nearly identical. And it's not something you can ask the Hubble Space Telescope Institute for, but they'd be happy to schedule a few. And then if you subtract one from the other, there's almost nothing left. We could not convince ourselves, modulo some subtraction error, that there was actually a host galaxy there about 4 or 5 magnitudes fainter. So here you have one of the most luminous quasars in the entire universe at redshift 6.4, and it has no host galaxy. So why is that? Yeah, go ahead.
It does have a host galaxy, right? We see it in the millimeter.
Right, I was going to get to that. It has no UV host galaxy, exactly right. So it does have a copious amount of dust, and the next slide after this will show that. And there is evidence for lots of molecular emission there as well. So this one, unfortunately, I think is far enough north that ELMA has not been able to do it, but it has been able to do others, I think. So on the, or is, do you remember what the coordinates for this one are?
This is a plus 52.
Yeah, so that's right. So this one is in the NOAO Whitefield Deep Survey. This is actually the one that has a host galaxy. We call it a host system. So there's the quasar, there's the PSF with a model. The model contains a point source at the location of the quasar, again, two filters, J and H, or 1.2, 1.6. And then two companion galaxies, which are dropouts at the shorter wavelengths. Here's what the actual data looks like with the quasar subtracted. So the quasar would be right in the middle. That causes a little bit corruption, but not nearly as much as the previous observation, because these quasars are a little fainter. I think this one was 20th magnitude or so. And so while there is no host galaxy right at the location of the quasar, there is two companion galaxies right nearby. So we argue that this is a giant merger. This is only one out of four or five cases done so far. Here's another one that has, again, nothing in it. And this is rest frame UV, of course, right? It's 1,500 or 1,800 angstroms in the rest. So it's just a naked quasar. So what's going on? Well, indeed, you're right. These quasars contain a lot of energy in the far IR and the submillimeter. And so if you look at the average, this is all in the rest frame now, just to guide the eye. This is for the redshift 6.4 quasar. Here's the average SED of a Sloan quasar with its variation. And if we normalize that to the data we actually get for this redshift 6.4 quasar in the far IR, here's where that roughly would fall. And here's our two upper limits from the null detections with HST Whitefield 3. And here's the other object, redshift 5.8, that only has one far infrared point, but it has two, you know, detections, or almost detections, in the rest frame UV. You can try to fit a family of models there, where there's a stellar population hump for the galaxy and a dust hump for the galaxy. Think of, you know, Centaurus A, which has stars and dust. And then it's clear that even this data, but certainly this data, rules out an ordinary spiral, which is this purple curve, ruled out in both cases, rules out an or actively star-forming spiral, or an ordinary spiral, barely allowed here, but not allowed there. But a dusty IRAS-like galaxy, or an ARP220, which is the brown model here, is actually perfectly allowed. It's only three data points. But, you know, the green model, IRS, some phone number, would be a decent fit. And it's indeed a galaxy with, you know, some active blue star population and a very significant dust hump. So I think that's what these high redshift quasars will turn out to be, you know, a star bursting system together with a copious amount of dust. And then unless there's just enough outflow to push the dust out, you may not actually see it in the far UV. However, when you go from the, you know, 1.2, 1.6 micron wavelengths further into the red, there's no question that especially an SED like this or like that will get rapidly brighter. So with JWST at these wavelengths, it should be easy to see the host galaxy. And so that would then complement all the work that far infrared and submillimeter, even ALMA, is now doing these days on these high redshift systems, because you'll get a stellar population hump here with James Webb, occasional emission line, and of course you get the far infrared and submillimeter there. We no longer have Herschel, although I learned this last week that SOFIA is actually a very good consolation prize for not having Herschel, because SOFIA has this instrument called Hawk, which is not all that much less sensitive than, actually it's about the same as Herschel per unit time, between 25 and 250 microns. So that's something to keep in mind. Here's a couple of other examples. Galaxies redshift 2, you know, observation, model, residual. This is the actual model plus the point source that was put there. In this case, the galaxy has a giant Arthur de Quadelot or Circe disk. In this case, there's not much of a host galaxy. In many cases, there is an excess of companion galaxies seen. We don't always have redshifts for those, but we think they're dynamical structures at the same redshift. So James Webb will be able to do many studies for this. Now last, I'll say a few words about the first light. I don't need to preach to you guys about this. You know much more than I do about first light. We think it started with pop 3 stars, redshifts 10 to 30, bigger than 100 solar masses. And occasionally these would go off a supernova. That's rare, although perhaps not totally impossible to see. We have some ideas about that. But most of those probably came in little star clusters or groupings, or just perhaps even an individual set of stars that were distributed through space, you know, following cosmic structure. We need good models for how exactly this happened. And this is what has, Andrea knows, concerned me for a long time. The Planck, 10 years ago, the WMAP year 1 and 3, and then year 5 and 7 and 9, and now Planck 2015 and 2016. The tau has come down, the optical depth for reionization has come down between 0.17 in 2003 to 0.055 today. It's come down by more than a factor of 3. Right, and back then we believed that reionization started at redshift 17 or 20, and a lot of activity there. And now, if you look at these numbers at face value, of course, it still doesn't have to be instantaneous. But if you assume it were instantaneous, that tau that you see here of 0.055 pretty much allows this family of models. And of course, the cyan model is not very physical, but you know, somewhere around 8 ± 1. In optical depth, as I pointed out after this morning's coffee talk, this number greatly concerns me because it doesn't leave a lot of volume in terms of ionizing power out here at the very high redshift that JWST was designed for. So I'm very happy that JWST works well at J-band and 1 micron, and I think we're going to see lots of these kinds of galaxies. Yes, it makes it easy. You don't have to do it from the moon.
No,
you can do it.
The bad news.
Well,
805,
8, 9.
The whole tau is bad for them. They don't like it. If you ask them, they complain.
No, they much.
They don't want 17, but they also don't want 5.
Why the sensitivity goes up?
Because it's a narrow range, really.
It's a narrow range, but
on the other hand,
if it was a 10, their sensitivity.
Well, those numbers are bad for them. They don't like them.
Anyway, so the real question is, how many objects will we really see at redshift 10 to 15? Is there anything out there that we can see at redshift 15? Well, let's see if we can answer that. So let me first say, I don't know how much time we have, but since I'm only here for 2 days and tomorrow. Yeah, tomorrow won't show any charts. We'll give you all the pretty pictures now. So this is the sensitivity in terms of units of CGS. This is what a ground-based telescope and Spitzer can do. Keck and Gemini, higher resolution, can do this. And of course, NERSPEC will get you roughly 10 to minus 18. This, I think, is in a day of integration time. So this is by no means an easy measurement. This is the NERCAM GRISM. And then the MIRI the thermal background kicks off at 5 microns or 4 microns. So MIRI has a little less sensitivity here, but still much better than Spitzer and anything you can do from the ground. So very roughly 10 to minus 17, easy 10 to minus 18, hard and a couple of times 10 to the 19 for very long integrations. What will that buy you? Well, 27, 28, 29th magnitude all the way up to 30th magnitude, redshift 8 here on the left, redshift 10 over there. In 100,000 seconds, so more than a day of integration time, really beautiful spectra of oxygen 3, H beta, the Lyman break, I think it's gorgeous spectra. Even 28 magnitude, you can clearly see it. 29th magnitude is pushing it, but not impossible. 29th magnitude, 2 microns. A little better redshift 10, you can still see oxygen 2, 37, 27, 507 sort of goes off the screen. Lyman break is still there, but 30th magnitude is sort of the limit. You do a little better with the GRISMs, but you get lower resolution. So for high resolution, to handshake with what you guys have thought about a lot of this workshop, what can we do for the ISM, high redshift galaxies? Well, you can do pretty decent medium resolution spectroscopy, an R of a few thousand, and fish out all your favorite emission lines, and do line ratios and dust constraints and ionization models and so on. I'll show a few more here.
Just for reference,
yeah.
Where does the redshift 11 galaxy fall on that?
The redshift 11 candidate that Ocean Company had, it'd be very similar to that. The break, I think, is at 1.5 microns, so it'd be a little further this way. That's actually a fairly bright object. I'm trying to call now how bright it is, maybe 26 or so, 27. So, you know, well, much spectrum should look like this. And of course, the Hubble data was not nearly as good, but it will be much brighter. So it will probably have the signal-to-noise ratio of this guy, or better, at a redshift of 11. So, you know, it will be like this, but stretch, probably you'll lose 507 and H beta, but you can probably see still 3727. And as I'll argue, you can see other lines here as well, especially if, you know, hopefully early AGN take off before the galaxies do, and you get the occasional AGN emission lines as well. So here's this object, CR7 by Sobral et al. Last year, beautiful asymmetric Lyman alpha line from the ground with VLT, MUSE, and Keck, and MOSFIRE, have you not. Here's a helium-2 line, 1640, you know, marker for POP 3 stars, and fairly bright, especially with XU there, was fairly clearly seen, I think. And here's another example. This is a redshift 6.6, sort of an end of the reionization phase when the universe was nearly fully ionized. And here's another one, redshift 4.1. This is high redshift radio galaxy, Texas survey with some phone number, clear Lyman alpha, and then some other higher ionization lines like carbon 4 and carbon 3. And there's also helium 2, 1640 here. And so objects like this, I think JW can, with its resolution of several hundred for the GRISM to several thousand for the spectrographs, should be able to do this fairly routinely, at least at 28 magnitude, out to redshifts as large as 30. Now, I don't think these objects will necessarily exist much past redshift 12 or 15. I'll get to that. Individual POP 3 stars, yes, but not a POP 3 star mini galaxy just as yet. And here's why. But anyway, if they exist, you can observe them this way. So here's the usual slate of filters and sensitivities. Redshift 10, you know, RIZ, the familiar filters, JHKL, and then several more in MIRI, all the way up to 27 microns if you like, but usually stop at 5 or 8 microns, including a few MIRI filters. You can clearly see the break. You just basically look for 4 filters with no signal and 3 or 4 filters with a clear signal, and there's your redshift estimate. And, you know, with a good stellar population model, should work pretty well. Now, so how well has this worked for the Hubble Ultra Deep Field? Here's all 841 orbits, or 592 hours. This is in 13 filters from the far UV to the near IR, anywhere between 28 and 31st magnitude per filter. This is the blue rendered version, so we emphasize the UV here because I was so proud of it with the Whitefield Camera 3, made sure that it had UV capability. And here's the IR rendering. It's the same photons, but weighed differently now, shown predominantly in the IR. Lots of foreground galaxies, of course. Here's the redshift 11 object. It's hard to see. I'll show you a better version in a minute. The important point is that in the entire deep field, there's only one, maybe a second somewhere, but people can't even agree on this one yet. Here's a redshift 9 object. There's 6 of those, 6 orange circles. And then you can just see it coming, redshift 7 and 8, there is more than 80 little green circles, and there's an object in every circle. So that's not seen in 12 filters, but only in H-band. That's not seen in 11 filters, but only in 140 and H, and the others are seen in 3 filters and not in the other 9. Here's a, what I call a chi-square image, so it's every filter collapsed, weighted with its signal-to-noise ratio. You can see all the photons better. 45% of the sky is covered here by galaxies. So, you know, we're getting close to the confusion limit. I'll get to that. You know, you integrate 500 hours with JWST, the sky will look like a globular cluster. no, seriously. So here's the redshift 8 candidates. You can see there's something in every green circle. There's the redshift 9 object. There's the redshift 11 candidates. So there's something there, but it was only seen in one filter. So you asked the question, I forgot to answer it. Oh, well, there is one redshift 11 object. The important point is that, you know, there's only one. Well, there is more objects at redshift 9. There's a whole lot more at redshift 7 and 8. So the star formation rate density drops pretty quickly, as you all know from the Madaw diagram. So let me skip this chart. You all know how gravitational lensing works, and I don't need to dwell at that at length other than to say, here's the H-band galaxy counts. Currently, we go to about 30th magnitude, get about 1 million objects per square degree. With JWST, when we go to 32nd magnitude, that will take 800 hours integration. It's probably the deepest it'll ever go. You get, you know, several million per square degrees. And when you start using lensing, you can probably see objects as faint as 34 intrinsically that get lensed into the sample. Now you're at a surface density of almost one object per square arc second, almost 10 million per square degree. So it gets pretty crowded up there, and we need to worry a little bit about how exactly the Schechter luminosity function behaves as a function of redshift. So a few years ago, it's been updated a little bit since then, but I collected everything that was known about the, and as you know, the Schechter function comes with a faint and slope, alpha, typically minus 1.2 or minus 1.3 nearby, and then close to minus 2 or even steeper at the higher redshift, as you know. Comes with a phi star and m star. Phi star is the density, m star is the characteristic luminosity, where that change from power law to exponential occurs. Data is still noisy, but there is a trend of phi star getting lower, you know, less numbers per cubic megaparsec at the higher redshift, quite substantially so, with some extrapolation here. I just used three ways of extrapolating it. And then M star actually shows a behavior that's similar to the Madaw diagram, saying that, you know, redshift 4, 5, 6 around the peak in the star formation history, around, you know, 1 plus Z of 4, the peak is really a redshift 3. The characteristic luminosity you see in M star is actually a little brighter in rest frame UV than it is today in the galaxy world, where it's around -18.5. The question is, what does this curve do at higher redshifts? We've sort of measured redshift 6 and 7, but beyond there, we don't know. That one object at redshift 11 in the Hubble Ultra Deep Field is this orange point here. The six objects redshift 9 is that point there. So there's a reasonable possibility, if the Hubble Ultra Deep Field is representative, that both M star drop like a rock and phi star drop like a rock, while alpha may be stable. Or that may not be true, but that's a guess. If that's the case, I'll sketch out for you the following Schechter landscape, all the way up to redshift 20, because this is what JWST will be contending with. Here's the surface density of quasars as a function of redshift, extrapolated from Sloan. Here's the surface density of galaxies. This is this physical space density. This is their physical luminosity. This is the observed AB magnitude, and this is the number you get per square degree. How do you read this graph? Let's say I do an ultra deep survey with JWST. I reach this limit, but I only do it in a very small field. And roughly this wedge over here is what I will pencil out. So only this part of the luminosity function I will see. And it's only at that level here, which is pink, a redshift 14, that I'll see one object per survey area. That's if the Schechter extrapolation that I sketched out for your previous graph is correct.
So it's only minus 15 here?
Say again?
It's only minus 15 without lensing?
That would be Magellanic Cloud, yeah.
The limit is minus 15.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for redshift 6. The scale's a little. So this scale maps onto that one. It's technically only true for redshift 6. Although we did slide it for the curves, this is the absolute magnitude you get at redshift 6. So at minus 15, or more precisely, 32nd magnitude, you see a redshift 14, about one object per survey area. If you take the Schechter extrapolation that I just penciled in the previous graph. If you go, however, over a wider area, let's say I now back off, I go less deep, but I increase my area. So I go down here, the orange wedge, and this is what I intend to do. We actually see fewer high redshift objects, but we get the brighter part of a luminosity function, including, hopefully, we'll see L star change from power law to exponential. And if we now point this sensitivity on lensing clusters, we gain an extra 2 or 3 magnitudes. So we start picking up this part of the rainbow. So my proposal would be to actually use James Webb very frequently on gravitationally lensing clusters, like the frontier field clusters, other clusters, clash, whatever is available. Needs to have good HST and hopefully also Spitzer data. So you get this extra wedge in sensitivity. So medium deep field will become this sensitive if you point it at a lensing cluster, and ultra deep field will become this sensitive. you pointed at a single lensing cluster. Now that's 800 hours on a single cluster. And again, the sky will start looking like a globular cluster. So that may not be what you want to do, but I think a medium deep field that covers say 10 clusters or so will be perfect to see, you know, a decent number of redshift 13, 14 galaxies. I personally doubt we'll see a lot of objects, redshift 15, but I may be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. So here's how it works. You all know this, you folks working on this here, beautiful imaging and also GRISM spectroscopy. We're in the process of picking out the best clusters. They come from Sloan, and Gamma Survey, and various other Planck and SPT. Ideally, I think you want to have a mass that's of the order of 10 to the 15 solar masses or higher. We don't actually want the high redshift clusters, the very highest redshift, because A, they're less massive, they may not be quite as realized, and B, what I didn't actually point out, the sweet spot of JWST sensitivity is between 3 and 5 microns. If you think that, you know, doing near-infrared imaging from CAC is hard compared to WIF3, where you gain 7 magnitudes in sensitivity because you went from Earth to low Earth orbit, you sacrifice all the atmospheric emission lines. Wait until you get to L2 at 3 and 5 microns. You gain more than a factor of 10,000 in sky brightness. And you don't want to corrupt that by moving your cluster to such a high redshift that the intercluster light itself, which peaks, of course, at 1.6 micron, where the SED of the old stars peaks, you don't want to move that all the way, redshift 1, into the 3 to 5 micron range. I think this is the sort of the sweet spot for sensitivity. So we've been looking at some clusters in this area, which includes Abel 370 and others, and predict the number of lensing objects they would give you to 29th magnitude or so, and compare that to actual counts. This is the number of objects you expect to see with the clash clusters, several hundred, with using these contours of lensed sources behind the clusters. And then there's some more here that might actually produce more than 1,000 images. And some of those, I think, is the most massive, the most compact cluster you can find in the sky. Maybe your best gravitational lensing. Let me just, for the sake of time, skip to the wave dark matter stuff. Put up my conclusions. So, schematically, we have to contend with three things, right? The catastrophic drop in the luminosity function, both space density and M star at the high redshift. And then it cannot see the forest for the trees effect. The sky will be so packed with images, especially if you integrate for 100 hours or more on a rich cluster to see the lensed sources in the background. You need to learn to disentangle all of these. So we actually need to come up with a new set of algorithms, sort of like source extractor that works on multiple wavelengths at the same time, to learn to subtract all the foreground sources very accurately to see the lens sources in the background. And then we need to use gravitational lensing, the house of mirror effects, to see the rarest first light sources, especially the objects redshift 12 to 15. And so what Einstein thought was impossible, see gravitational lensing, I'm afraid James Webb will have to do routinely. So these are my conclusions. I've said a ring, so I'm not going to hash it out again. Your proposals are due less than 1 year and 7 months from today, I think. So thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah.
So very, very significant difference from a global cluster is that in global cluster, you know, there are point sources, so you
yeah.
can specify PSF and that's it, whereas just galaxies, you don't know what the intrinsic profiles are, right? So these
yeah.
things that are confused. So what is the current thinking of what are the algorithms that you would?
Well, you'd have to either come up with very accurate surface profiles. Of course, it's hard to model any of these. All of these big things in the foreground are ellipticals, even though they show spiral arms. That's because the UV is shining through. But and they're not, I don't know whether I can do this here, but they're not ordinary ellipticals. They got a lot of dwarfs, presumably at the same redshift, or things falling in, maybe projected foreground objects. So it is already hard to isolate a bright galaxy here, and we need to learn to perfectly subtract the bright galaxies to find the stuff in the background for the...
It's not that we need to do this, but is there thinking of how to do this?
There is a recent paper by Rachel Livermore and Steve Finkelstein and others that made it into ABJ, where they use wavelets. So they make a good model for the foreground elliptical, and in the halo of the elliptical, they try to find lensed sources in the background. In fact, their goal was to measure the luminosity function, redshift 6, 7, 8, behind these clusters. These are the frontier field clusters, to outrageously faint limits. I think they went well below minus 15, I think. They reached minus
12 and a half.
Say again?
Minus 12 and a half.
Yeah, minus 12 and a half.
You actually believe that this is...
Well, I looked at it carefully. It seemed like it was approximately right. The problem is you don't necessarily only want to subtract the foreground profile of the elliptical with all its companions. But, you know, for the longest time, we thought we saw some other redshift 10 and 11 objects in the background here. It's actually not that. It's actually the halo of this redshift 1 elliptical, which is very red, and it's, by the way, it's the same redshift as this object, and they both have some tidal effects which shows up at a level of 30th magnitude per square arc second. So you need to subtract that too. So it's not just a galaxy, but any diffuse halo light as well. And of course, in a cluster, it gets even more messy. You can only imagine that this frontier field cluster here, where is it now? Boy, if you have to subtract all these objects and then look for the, you know, red objects in the background that are gravitationally lensed, not these blue things, which are easy, but things like that that are stretched and lensed, that will become very hard. And that's what we'll need to do. So if anybody has any ideas how to write the best software to do that, it needs to be multi-wavelength. We've got plenty of filters, so you can use the information about the object in the foreground to subtract it well. Sort of radio astronomers cleaning at multi-wavelengths at the same time or so, I think, is what we have to learn to do. But it's a beautiful problem, and the more data you have, the more objects you measure like this, and lensed, and even that's a lensed object, I think, in the red, and there's another one there and there. But the more of those you have, as you well know, the better this lensing model becomes. And of course, you need the redshifts for these things, but even an approximate redshift would help, especially if you find the multiple images. So these lensing models for these clusters have gotten a lot better over the years, especially since CAC and VLT have measured, and of course also a project like GLASS, which I think is done here, where you measure the redshifts with the GRISM for these objects, makes the cluster model a lot better. So we'll have to do all that. It's going to be a lot of work. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, please.
Can you tell us about how is structured the proposal? Are there large program consortium that are setting up?
Now you're getting to my spare charts. Mm-hmm. Spare chart number one. How is
okay.
So we're here, mm-hmm. and we as GTOs have a proposal due in April next year, which tells the community what we plan to do with our guarantee time, which will probably be some clusters. We're thinking about even putting some data public right away, so everybody gets to look at it. And why is this important? Well, because at the end of, I think in August or September 2017, the deadline is for community proposals for the ERS, the Early Release Science. This is not yet the original proposal. That call comes out about a month later, about Thanksgiving 2017, and your proposals will be due in February 2018. Mm-hmm. So a little less than 2 years from now. But the ERS is already due earlier. It's due in a year and 4 months or so. And then the TAC will meet in May that year, about 4 months before launch. Launch is here, still holding for October. Of course, if launch gets delayed for whatever reason, then the whole system will stretch. And then this will get repeated every year. So presumably every February, there is cycle 2, cycle 3, cycle 4 deadline. So it's not too early to start thinking about it. I have some links, I think they may be on this next page, where you can, you're probably familiar with the Hubble proposal system, which is here on the STSCI website. If you go to JWST instruments or any one you like, you can find an exposure time simulator, and there's even already a preliminary version of the APT, which is the proposal tool that lets you schedule. That's not very accurate yet, but the exposure time simulator is there, and that's pretty accurate. We think it's 20% accurate or so. So it'll give you good value for, you know. how much time your observation will take. So based on this previous chart, I think the answer is, you know, get ready because it's only a year away.
Is there any plan to have larger projects
and
this kind of stuff?
Yeah, so part of this package here will announce a mix between treasury, large and medium, small. How exactly they're going to define that, I don't know, but if Hubble is any measure, I think anything over 100 hours will be large. Mm-hmm. If you want several hundred hours, let's say, to find your favorite redshift 16 objects, you better have a large team. You better make your data available to everybody in the community right away, like a Hubble Treasury program also does. But I think it will be possible. I don't think, I don't know this for sure, but I don't think the tech will necessarily give out, let's say, an 800-hour integration on your favorite cluster in year one, because we don't know how well the telescope will perform. Mashariki will do 100 hours on each of two deep fields, in the Hubble Ultra deep field in the south, and then the Goods North is small, and there'll be 25 hours per filter. So that's pretty deep. It's about as deep as, well, it was on the chart, although I didn't point it out, but
so this would be done.
She will be about 30 and a half magnitude or so, this line here. And she will do one or two fields, so she'll carve out this part. But if you wanted to do 800 hours on a single field and go another magnitude and a half deeper, you could, but that probably will have to wait till year two until this performance is proven. That's why it's important to get the early release science data out really soon so everybody gets a look at it.
So the Hubble deep field will be done immediately, just after
launch? Yeah, there will be... there will be some public data right after launch. The early release science gets scheduled together. See, the GTO data needs to be all scheduled within 3 years, but 50% of it needs to be scheduled in the first year. And while that data is proprietary, we probably won't keep it all under lids. We'll certainly make sure that some sampling is available on a cluster or a random deep field or medium deep field. So at the very least, you get to test the exposure time simulator, make sure it gives the right answer, and that the data behaves like you want, and that the stray light is under control and all that. Yeah, good questions. Other questions, yes?
Is there a predefined fraction of the time that will be allocated to a certain scientific topic, or is it going to be pressure-based?
It's a sort of a controlled democracy there. maybe like British democracy. we had this discussion over lunch. So it is somewhat proportional to proposal pressure, but there's also a way of making sure that every field is fairly represented. So if the exoplanet community decided that this is all more important than first light, which I've heard rumors to that effect, and that they therefore need 95% of the exposure time in the first year, that's not going to fly. On the other hand, you know, they are a big community and they're going to come up with lots of good proposals. So the director will put some, as you know, the current HST tech, which met this last week, they have 14 panels, and usually they're two mirror panels to avoid conflicts of interest. So there's, let's say, an AGN panel, nearby galaxy panel, two of each, distant galaxy panel, planetary panel, stellar population panel, hot stars, cold stars or something. And that's right, you were on the panel a few years ago, yeah. And anyway, the point is that these panels pretty much each got a proportional fraction of the total time that they get to divide out, and that's pretty much proportional to proposal pressure within some variation, because some projects just take more time than others and they're yet equally important.
So they'll have the same, like the HST, they'll give
there will be somewhat predetermined. Now, there's always surprises possible. Who knows what will get discovered between now and then? Mm-hmm. And maybe new fields will come and require more time. Maybe other things like Hubble in the old days in year one and two. The first 3 years of Hubble, a lot of things were impossible because of fair collaboration. So certain proposals were just, you know, brushed off the table, had to wait for refurbishment. Let's hope that that's not the case. But something could happen that makes the performance in some regard less than we thought. Mm-hmm. How's that?
Well,
all right. You're welcome. It was fun. You guys have lots of good questions. I'll be around today and tomorrow, so be happy to answer more questions and. Then we'll do an informal talk about the lessons learned from James Webb tomorrow, right?
Yes.
Only handwritten lessons. No jokes, because all my jokes are from the church. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. What's your name, buddy?
Andre Kotsov.
Okay, of course, Andre, yeah. Yeah.
So, you mentioned
yeah. Yeah.
That's something that's kind of known, but for me it was a bit of so if I quote,
yeah.
If I quote, say,
shall I make some more light here? That gives a bit more. Yeah.
If I quote stagnation rate of functional scale mass,
yeah.
So I did this for gamma survey,
yeah.
I think other people have seen it in pages.
Yeah.
There is a stagnation sequence.
Yeah.
Standard one.
But yeah.
There is a second sequence that's parallel.
Yeah.
Very similar, right?
Right.
It's about 2 orders magnitude below.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quasi galaxies. Right?
Yeah.
So is UV light that you were showing, is this guy,
yeah,
here?
Yeah. So there is some papers by.
Yeah. Because, you know, for me it was a bit surprising because I see it not emphasized at all in observational papers,
yeah.
At least the most. And I've asked several observers, and some of them didn't know about it at all.
Yeah.
Because it
usually. Yeah. So Kaviraj, well, there's others who started it, but Kaviraj really made an industry out of it with the Galaxy World. We've been working with him. So he discovered this, and others have seen it too, but he did a very systematic study with Galaxy. And then he and my student, Mike Rutkowski, we did white field camera 3, the UV, had 3 filters, this 2012 and 2014 paper. And so we saw that almost every galaxy that's an early type has some residual star formation, but it's usually very little. It's maybe,
sure,
yeah.
It's about total
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But right. What I find striking is they're parallel, like it's the same
yeah.
Even though it's really kind of
yeah. Yeah, this is just a leftover gas that makes it in and shocks, and this is just part of the original star formation where the gas supply is still substantial,
yeah,
of course. At high redshift, the gas supply is much higher, and the thinking is that these galaxies run out of gas well before these did, and so they just use whatever leftover gas they have.
Yeah. Well, in principle, in these guys,
yeah.
The amount of gas is expected from just stellar mass loss is huge.
Right.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
yeah.
You don't see the gas; the star should be moving, which is the usual explanation for supernova type 1A.
Right.
Run into away.
Right.
But seems like we do have another gas.
Right, yeah.
But from the theory standpoint, I find it interesting the observations and
yeah.
The surface density summation.
I would think that has to do with the fundamental plane of galaxies where both ellipticals and spirals seem to know somehow what environment they grew up in. And that must have driven probably the gravity of the local environment, driven the infall rates and driven the star formation rates.
The size of the function of stellar mass is quite similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially if you work from projected.
Yeah.
For integrals in the projected one, if you multiply by 1.34 and get
yeah.
3D, then this radius
yeah.
of the function of stellar mass for spherules is very
yeah.
similar to spirals.
So I would expect this for spirals to be like this at higher redshifts. Yeah.
Yeah,
just move up. And maybe made a little slightly lower mass.
Right.
And I'd expect this to do the same thing, except it moves up more because ellipticals, you know, were more actively star forming, you know, redshift 2 than they are today. So maybe one time in the past they were the same population, but because the dynamical structure is so different, ellipticals pretty much triaxial ellipsoids, you know, leftovers from mergers or massive infall, while spirals are still more slowly accumulating gas. And
so you have first also, right?
Yeah. Kaviraj et al. And Rutkowski et al. I'm part of the second set of papers. He was my student. Kaviraj was pretty much the one who started this with Galax well, there's other people who found this before, right? There's a whole slew of papers you can find in the 1980s and 90s about UV light in ellipticals nearby, but that's different, right? The
Right. I don't see more. The question you always see like red and dead.
Yeah. No, they have.
In their question, but
yeah. Never quite red and dead. So if you look at ellipticals nearby, this was first found with IUE in the 1970s and 80s, and also studied a lot in the 90s with the early generation of HST instruments. You can find a lot of ellipticals. I'm going to say the majority, although not all of them, they have a far UV upturn, right? So this far UV light. Well, or hot horizontal branch stars. Yeah, they're not necessarily the planetary nebula cores of white dwarfs. They could be white dwarfs. They could be helium burning stars or something that gets really hot. But they're all